Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility and Adoption. I'm Dawn Davenport, the director of Creating a Family. We're a nonprofit providing resources, education, and support for infertility and adoption. You can find us at creatingafamily.org. Each week, I post a blog on a topic relevant to infertility or adoption, and this week my blog is titled, Having Your Cake and Eating It Too, Can You Continue an Infertility Treatment While Applying to Adopt? I post regularly on Facebook and Twitter about infertility and adoption and just life in general. You know, in fact, we've had a very lively discussion on the blog on my blog topic this week over at Facebook. So please join us and add your voice to the discussion as well. On Twitter, I'm Dawn Davenport 1, and Facebook, I'm Dawn.Davenport 1. And you can join the Creating a Family Facebook group where we routinely share interesting talks. And you can find the Creating a Family Facebook group by typing in Creating a Family in the Facebook search box. We publish a video on YouTube every couple of weeks, and you can watch all of our videos on either infertility or adoption by going to the, under infertility and adoption or horizontal menu, just clicking on the video page. Another service Creating a Family offers is consulting with you personally about questions and decisions you're facing with infertility or adoption. I can give you unbiased advice and information that can help you make the decision on whether to stay in treatment or move up the treatment ladder or move on to adoption, as well as deciding what type of adoption might be right for your family and how to find an agency and how to increase the odds of finding a child. You can check out our consulting page at YouGotItCreatingAFamily.org. We send out a weekly email on the latest developments on the infertility and adoption fronts, as well as the upcoming week's blog and show topics. So I would encourage you to sign up for these updates on our website. If you have benefited from this show or our site, please tell others. Word of mouth is how we work, and it really helps more than you think if you will spread the word about the show. Today's show is going to be on how to choose an egg donor. Our guests to discuss egg donation are Teresa Erickson. She is an attorney who practices exclusively in the area of family formation, surrogacy, egg and sperm donation, as well as embryo donation. We also have Nancy Block. She is the co-founder of the Donor Network Alliance, which goes by the very appropriate acronym DNA. DNA is an affiliation of U.S. egg donor agencies throughout the United States that compile donors from many different agencies and allowing intended parents to have a greater selection of donors to choose from. We also have Dr. Richard Sherbon. He is the founder, medical director, and laboratory director of the Advanced Fertility Centers of Chicago. He is board certified in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Welcome Nancy Block, Dr. Richard Chabon, and Teresa Erickson to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
By the time folks reach the point of knowing that they need to use a donated egg to conceive, they have already had to go through so many decisions and have gone through so much in general that for some, just the thought that they now have to choose a person to donate eggs, it just can be overwhelming. So what we hope is to demystify the process a little bit today. So let's start with some of the very basics. Nancy Block, how much information, or maybe the better way to ask it is, how detailed is the information that is usually available on a potential donor, that the intended parents are the people who are selecting and are going to use the donated egg, also known as the intended parents, that they will have access to?
Once an intended parent looks at a profile, that's what we call them, she'll see all of the non-identifying information about a donor, her health history, her medical history, her family health history, her aunts, uncles, grandparents, cousins, educational background, physical characteristics. She will see a picture, a grown picture, you know, an adult picture, a childhood picture as well, whatever the donor's willing to share. And basically everything that her doctor or their doctor would see except for how to identify her.
Okay, well, Dr. Chabon, what type of screening should prospective parents expect an agency or a clinic to do for a potential donor before they select?
Well, we could talk for an hour about that.
Oh, please, let's don't.
Exactly.
We have way too much to cover.
Exactly. So I think screening varies a little bit from program to program, but infectious disease screening is done on all egg donors at some point before they donate. That is mandated by the FDA and was done even before the FDA mandates came out in 2005. We screen our donors for fertility issues using various methods before we accept them into our donor pool. And as has already been mentioned, there's medical history, family history. Psych screening is usually done at some point before they're used, not necessarily before they're chosen, depending on how a program does that. But it's extensive, and so there are many aspects to the screening process.
Well, you raised something that I had a question about. Is all this screening done before you select the donor or after you select the donor, Dr. Chabon?
I think it's done. I don't think there's a standard. In our case, for example, we do some of the screening before anyone chooses a donor. But, for example, the psych screening that we do costs $500 for us to pay the psychologist, and some of the donors that we put on our list will never be used. So we don't send them immediately for psych screening. We send them after someone has shown an interest and potentially wants to use that donor.
Does DNA do the same way? The screening? I suppose if a donor has already donated, then that screening is at least the psych screening would still be available from the previous donation. But
there are a couple of ways to answer that. First of all, every agency operates differently. Some agencies, if they have multiple donors, won't screen probably every donor that they have ahead of time for the psychologist. If they have fewer donors, they'll probably do that, but there are costs involved, and of course we don't know if every donor will get matched. But generally what happens is if a donor is a repeat donor, she will have some screening already available, but we should update some of that screening. The donor should probably talk to a psychologist once a year and probably repeat their MMPI-2 once every 2 years.
Okay, and I think that Dr. Chabon, you answered this, but it would seem like it would be important to know how the potential donor might, how easily she might be stimulated using fertility drugs. Is there a way to test to see if she is a likely a good candidate?
Yes, that gets done at some point. We do it before the donor, because we're a medical facility. It's a little different the way we do it. That's the very first thing we do with the donor. We do some questions on the phone when they call to say, I want to donate eggs. And then we have them come in, fill out a questionnaire, and do an ultrasound, which I find to be the most useful tool to look at the potential for stimulating well. And we're looking at an antral follicle count. So when I started doing egg donation in 1997, we didn't have antral follicle counts. The ultrasound equipment wasn't good enough to see the small antral follicles in the ovaries. But eventually some smart doctor figured out that this was a useful tool, and many of us started using it. So I want the donors to have at least 16 antral follicles, and those donors will 99% plus respond well to the medications. We do see young girls with low antral follicle counts, which is surprising, but we will tell them then and there that their ovaries don't look good enough, which isn't a great medical word, but
no, probably not, but accurate.
Well, their ovaries look sleepy, is how we sometimes say it, and not likely to respond well to medications, and that's upsetting for a young girl to hear. On the other hand, we don't think they're going to be good donors, and we don't take them.
Yeah, and one other medical question. Does the donor have to have a blood type that is compatible with the mother? And in specific, I guess I'm thinking about the Rh negative, you know, if that's important to match the negative or positive.
I don't believe it's important, no. The option that someone has if they're negative would be to choose a negative donor as well. But if their husband or partner is positive, or the sperm donor, depending on what is involved, they're going to need Rogam during the pregnancy anyway. So a Rhogram shot is given to women that are Rh negative during pregnancy, and I don't feel that there's any need for them to limit the pool of donors to an Rh negative or an exact match. I do see women that say, I want the perfect blood match, blood type match, because I don't ever want my child to know, and if they see blood hanging by my bed someday and they can figure out that that doesn't work with their blood type, that that could be an issue. So sometimes we've seen recipients that insist on matching the blood type, but that's a personal reason rather than a medical reason.
Here's a question from Sarah. My husband and I are both really laid back. We worry that it would be a very hard adjustment to get a really high-strung kid. How can you determine things like basic personality traits in a potential donor, or is it even realistic to try? Nancy Block, what do you think on that question?
Oh, I think that's a loaded question because there are so many different things that you can try and look for in a donor, but honestly, I think there are certain characteristics that you have a greater chance of inheriting and certain characteristics you don't. I think the most important thing in when parents are looking at a donor profile is whatever is most important to you, you'll maybe get a feel for what you're looking for, physical characteristics, educational background, personality type. Those issues could be focused on and they can stick with that, but the bottom line is we want them to choose a donor who will produce a good amount of eggs and produce a pregnancy for them. And some of those characteristics and personality types are how a child's raised. And so we can't really figure that out.
We just did a Creating a Family show in December 9th, 2009, where we had on as our guest, the title of the show was on Nature versus Nurture. And we had the two of the leading the directors of the twin studies here in the United States on and talking about what the research is showing about how much is influenced by genetics and how much is influenced by the environment that you're raised in. So I would recommend anybody who's curious about that because it was an absolutely fascinating show. Nancy, now I want to ask you about how intended parents, somebody who is thinking about using a donated egg, how do they go about finding a potential egg donor? What are the options?
Well, when you go to the DNA Donor Network Alliance website, you can look for a donor with specific criteria. You can fill in optional filters. You can look for a donor with your hair color, eye color, ethnicity. Really, there's a slew of things that you can look for. You can also look for a donor who lives close to you. You can work with a donor who travels. You can work with a donor from an agency across the country. So really, the options are limitless. We have nearly 5,000 donors on the site now, and for some people that's a little overwhelming. We do assist people if they need help. And the agencies that we work with are all terrific. Teresa's agency is also on DNA, and they're most helpful in assisting intended parents to find the right match.
Teresa, do the intended parents present the criteria that is important to them, say for you, and then does the clinic select the donor, or is it the other way around that the intended parents select the donor and then bring that donor to the clinic?
Well, I mean, it could happen either way. I mean, there's no real hard and fast rules because you want to give, you know, parents the option to do what's best for them. So either they will select the donor beforehand and then go to the clinic, or I see some intended parents that will say, I think I like her, but I want my doctor to give the final okay before we go forward. And either way works. It just depends on the agency you're working with and how the parents want to proceed.
And Dr. Chabon, is it any different when you're working with a clinic versus a network of donor agencies?
No, I don't think so. We've always done it with basically taking the deck of cards and turning them all face up for people to see everything that we know about the donors and pick the donor that's best for the couple. And I think that's what I'm hearing the others say as well. There certainly are programs that do it differently and ask intended parents what they're looking for through a questionnaire or however they do it, and then say, well, this donor looks perfect for you, or these two do. But I think clinics do the same thing as well. So I think it's just a matter of how the clinic or the agency wants to work it.
Teresa Erickson, are there any licensing requirements or other legal requirements that donor agencies must meet and that prospective parents should check before choosing a donor egg program or agency?
Well, I mean, in general, the states don't have any sort of licensing for egg donation agencies, but there are a couple of things that people should look for. I mean, really based on, you know, reputation, talking to the clinic, talking to, checking with the Better Business Bureau, checking with their state to see if they're a licensed corporation, and if not, their business license is actually in effect. And just doing a background check, in a sense, by talking to other people. I mean, that's really all people can do as far as that's concerned. There are a few rules, I mean, in terms of, I should say not rules, but guidelines that the ASRM puts forth. And I think it's important to definitely work with an agency that looks at the ASRM guidelines in a proactive way and tries to follow them as closely as possible.
And we link to that. We will have a page up on our site by the end of today that will link to a list of egg donor programs that have stated that they will abide by the ASRM Ethics Committee guidelines governing payment of egg donors. You know, I will point out that it is a self-reporting list, and it's not a verified list by either of ASRM or the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology. Nonetheless, it does indicate that an agency, at least in theory, abides by these guidelines. Dr. Chabon, what should someone look for when they are trying to decide on an egg donor program?
When you say program, you mean clinic or you mean agency?
Well, it's a good question. Either way. And how does somebody decide whether to use a clinic or to go outside of the clinic and use an egg donor agency?
That's a good question that I don't know the answer to. The people that come to me for egg donation often are considering using an agency or our donors. And so we work with people that get a donor through an agency or that want to use one of our donors. Sometimes we don't have a donor that they feel is suitable for them, and they will come to see us first, and then if we don't have a donor that suits their needs, they'll then seek out an agency and come back to us with a donor to do the egg donation cycle. What I would recommend for intended parents in terms of what clinic to use, whether they're going to get a donor there or they're going to get it through an agency, is to look at the SART data or the CDC data and take a clinic that has respectable success rates. The government report comes out every year, and live birth rates are available going all the way back into the 90s. For any respectable clinic in the country. So
right.
National.
We link to that, and we've done a number of shows on that, so that's an excellent suggestion.
I think a lot of the choices depend on what the intended parents are looking for in a donor, and in the past when we started 10 years ago, I have my own egg donor agency. When we started 10 years ago, intended parents were looking for the right fit as far as agency, and now I think they're looking for the right fit as far as donor. So it seems as though the agency is a little less, and you know, regardless of the doctor's office, the agency that they're choosing will have the donor that they want. And then they look at the agreement and all of the other statistics that an agency may have. But they
it's
are
an
pretty,
interesting transition, I guess.
It is. They're very, very linked to their donor.
Which actually makes sense. Here is a question we got from Lindy. I'm so glad you're doing this show today. We have decided to go with an egg donor for our upcoming cycle, and I think the next step is for us to pick a donor. We are trying to decide on what things we should look for. I have a really beginner's question. Do most people choose a donor that looks like the mother or that looks like the father? We will be using my husband's sperm. Teresa Erickson, you want to give a shot, try at that one?
Well, I mean, it's different for everyone, but in general, I think that most people try to look for if they don't look for someone that looks especially like the intended mother, they do look for someone that will help, you know, basically will fit in their family. So it can be a gambit of looking like the husband, looking like the mother, but again, somebody that may fit into their family structure in terms of how that child will end up looking, or we're guessing, of course, how the child will end up looking, but in general, I think that's really what they try to do.
Nancy, what are the factors in your experience do couples find important when choosing a donor? Things like hobbies, talents, academics, things like that. What, and I realize it would depend on each individual couple, but or person who's choosing. But what do you find are the important things that people are considering?
I think a lot of that has to do with what they've gone through at that point, you know, how much infertility treatment they've gone through. If they've chosen adoption as a way of family building as well, because I think some people are more open to their choice if they've gone through years and years of fertility treatments or through adoption. A lot of it is just someone getting a feel for a donor. Some people who've gone through an awful long struggle and, you know, countless years and, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars for treatment may choose a donor who will just simply get them pregnant. Would it have the best chance? A repeat donor, someone who's had a pregnancy, someone who's had a child. Some people will strictly look for a donor who looks like the intended mom, someone who looks like she can fit in their family, like Teresa said, is also very common. Depending on ethnicity and how selective someone is, that also may be a huge factor. But I think help from an agency that's supportive, guidance, you know, without telling a recipient who to choose, but if she's got a couple of choices, we can send that to the doctor's office, see who they like for that patient. We can help them make that decision based on previous cycles or really what they're looking for.
Here's a question from Randolph. My partner and I are planning on using a donor to have a baby with a surrogate this year. We want to see pictures of the donor as a child and as an adult. Is this possible? Can we also hear a tape of her speaking? We would also like to have her evaluated psychologically by an independent psychologist. Is this possible? So he asked a number of questions. Dr. Chabon, in your practice, at your clinic, is this type of information available, the pictures, the tape of her speaking, as well as the ability to have a third party, an independent psychologist, evaluate her?
Being a medical clinic, have tended to focus less on the presentation of the donor than many of the agencies do. And I think it's a good thing. What the agencies have evolved over the years, and of course they're not all the same, but some of them have videos and various presentations of the donor available. We don't do any of that. We have, as I said, we do psych evals through an independent psychologist. No one's ever asked for an independent one separate from that, but if they did, I wouldn't have a problem with it. The couple would have to pay for it. But no, we don't do any audio recordings or video recordings or anything like that. We haven't had requests for that. I would think the same thing from our perspective. If the couple wanted it, we could request it from the donor and the couple mm-hmm. could pay for it potentially.
And if the donor was amenable, then that would be something. Let's see, Nancy, since you work with a group of clinics, what do you see, not clinics, I'm sorry, agencies, what do you see as far as what's available from the agencies within your affiliate?
Well, on DNA, we have agencies that will do videos. We have agencies that will introduce recipients or intended parents to their donor. They'll do a conference call. We, at my company, will do an anonymous conference call if they'd like to speak to each other, a meeting, if that's something that everyone wants to do. I think the agencies really have evolved and decided that whatever's requested and best seemingly for the intended parents is something that we're all pretty willing to do, as long as everyone understands what the long-term effects might be and that significant identifying information really isn't given other than first names.
Teresa, we got a number of questions, and I'm just going to group them all together and under kind of the legal rubric here. Are there any legal requirements that prospective parents need to do to make sure that they, any requirements that, that intended parents need to make sure they follow so that they are the legal parents of the child?
Well, I think what's really important for intended parents are just, when we're just focusing on egg donation, I don't want to get into surrogacy, that's a whole separate issue.
Yeah, let's don't, yeah.
Are two things, it's twofold. I mean, there is an informed consent with the clinic, and it's important for them to make certain that they read through the informed consent, are clear about what disposition issues are regarding the embryos, and then to move on and have an actual agreement between themselves and the donor. I think that's important because it's a standalone document. It basically gives, it basically is the donor stating her intentions that she wants no information, no contact, I mean, based on everything that put in there. There are some parents who do want to, you know, have information on the donor, maybe for future medical, and we put all of that in the agreement, and it makes it nice and clean and easy, and everybody knows that where everybody else stands in terms of the whole process.
Yeah, exactly, because I do see, I don't know if it's a trend, but I do see people who are wanting the ability to contact the donor, and I loosely call it in a semi-open relationship, particularly for medical information and for the donor to be able to update her medical information and for the family to be able to share any medical information or any questions they have with the donor. So all that needs to be within the intent document. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. It does.
Okay.
And most of the agencies do ask the donors to keep in touch, ask the intended parents to keep in touch so that we can get medical information about them and their family to them in the future. And we ask for social security numbers and address and birth date so that we can find them in the event we need to get that information to them.
Nancy, how much does an average egg donation cost and what factors affect the cost?
Not including medical, I can give you what our fees are in the Chicago area. An agency fee is anywhere from $5,000 to $6,000. The donor compensation is about $7,000. Most donor compensation in this area is, in the neighborhood of $7,000 because of our cost of living in Chicago. And the legal for the donor is included in many of the contracts. The legal for the intended parents runs in the neighborhood of about $700. If the donor's legal is not included, her legal consult is about $500. In the agency fees, we include the psychological evaluation by an independent counselor. We include the donor legal. We include the donor insurance in the event that there's a complication, she is covered, and the intended parents aren't responsible for those fees after. At my program, we do genetic screening, genetic counseling. So that is also included. We don't really bill for any medical costs. Those will go through the doctor's office. And in this state, in Illinois, there's a mandate for insurance to pay for cycles. So it's very reasonable if your insurance does cover infertility, it should cover four cycles for IVF, which can include an egg donor. And
okay,
those cycles,
the insurance can include the egg donor. Okay, excellent.
They can include the egg donor. Some insurance don't find a problem, and I think Dr. Sherban can probably answer some of this better than me, but some insurances will find that the egg donor is the same as the patient, the intended mother. So they'll cover medications and office visits and ultrasounds and blood work and, you know, all of the FDA requirements.
You know, Dr. Sherban, the cost she's giving was $13,000 to $14,000, I think, and that's not including medical, but the medical for the egg donor would be similar, would it not, to the medical that you would be, the woman would be, the intended mom would be spending if she was going through the cycle, or is the cost different?
Again, I think it depends on the program. There's a lot more work involved for us for a donor cycle than for someone using their own eggs, so we charge more than we do for someone using their own eggs. For the FDA issues that are involved and multiple aspects of the more complicated nature of a donor egg cycle, it is more for the clinic. I think some clinics may not charge much more, and some will charge a lot more for a donor cycle.
So
our costs here are $25,000 for the entire cycle for the self-pay patients. So that includes a donor fee and agency fees and everything. So I know that some clinics are less than that, and some are 30 or 35 or even 40,000 for a donor cycle.
Teresa, I have heard from some parents that they have to pay an agency to even look at the profiles. Is that typical in your experience?
I do see that happen with some agencies. I really think that the parents should have the option to just kind of go through and get the information, but every agency is different. So if that's something that, you know, the agent or the intended parent is really against, I mean, you can always contact the agency. Some will willingly let you go ahead and have access to their information. But it's about 50-50 across the industry in terms of those who have to pay and those who can just go through the information.
All right, and the when we're talking about costs, that leads to the question of sharing a donor. Most young women who are going to stimulate will produce many eggs. So what are the advantages and the disadvantages to sharing a cost of a donor with another couple and then sharing the eggs? I'll start with you, Dr. Chabon, and I'd also like, Nancy, for you to weigh in on this issue.
Okay.
Advantage would be reduced costs. I can't think of any other advantage. Disadvantage would be less eggs and less flexibility in terms of timing of getting it done. We have had donors since the late 90s, and we have done some egg-sharing cycles, but very few. If the couples want it, so I'm not against it, but the couples that I see that want to do egg donation with us, they basically want all the eggs, and they don't want to share them to save several thousand dollars at that point is what I'm seeing. I think a lot of egg sharing is done at clinics that have very few donors, and the patients don't want to wait longer or find another place to find a donor. So more cycles are able to be done, and more intended parents can go through a cycle if they reduce the cost and split the eggs between two couples.
I see it. I'm seeing a lot less egg sharing now, donor sharing, I'm sorry, than I have in the past. Nancy, what are you seeing?
Well, I think a lot of it depends on, and I'm sure Teresa can weigh in on this too, the states that cover infertility treatment and will cover through their insurance companies, because if you're in a state like Illinois, most people don't want to do egg sharing. They don't want to share a donor. The donor also would be at a disadvantage because her donor compensation would be reduced. Essentially, she'd be getting $3,500 for a cycle if she's a $7,000 donor doing a cycle for two families. So, you know, not only the flexibility would be decreased, but the donor would be at a disadvantage there too. I think that there are states that will definitely work with two donors or three donors possibly for intended parents to keep those costs down, but I don't think we see a lot of that in states where it's mandated for coverage for insurance.
Unfortunately, the states that are mandated are fewer than the states that are not.
There are just a few. I happen to live in a good state, Illinois, but there are just a few. But I think that everyone seems to be at a disadvantage. People seem to be very focused on not just doing a fresh cycle, but they want to do a frozen. They want to have that opportunity to have another baby with the same DNA.
Mm-hmm.
They want to have an opportunity, if they miscarry or not, you know, conceive the first time, have that second chance or possibly third chance. So while the costs are, you know, heavy, I think if you go to a good reproductive center, a good clinic, the odds are with you and not against you if you use just one donor.
Teresa, what happens if you select a donor and she goes through a cycle and produces very few eggs? Who assumes that risk of the financial risk of saying only ending up with one or two embryo?
Unfortunately, it's the intended parents, unless there's something that was caused due to something that the donor had done. Usually what I recommend to clients is that, you know, when the doctor's talking with you, and I'm sure the doctor does the same thing, is when the doctor's monitoring the donor, if there is a low egg count, if it's possible, stop the cycle, because, and again, the doctor can talk about this a little bit more, but you know, if the donor's only going to have one or two eggs that are retrieved, you know, and the expense that you've gone through at this point, and then to pay the donor her compensation is often, you know, a difficult thing to swallow. So it's really something that really needs to be discussed right from the get-go with the doctor.
But wouldn't you all owe her her compensation, regardless of how many eggs are produced?
Well, I know through most programs, really the donor has to go through the actual retrieval in order to receive the majority of her compensation. That's usually pretty much the standard, although I've seen some different situations. But if she goes through the retrieval, and if there's only one egg, or if no egg or embryos are created at all, she would still be due her compensation, yes.
Nancy, how does DNA handle that? If a woman goes through, and let's say the intended parents say, you know, gosh, we were hoping to get at least 10 eggs and you only have 8, mm-hmm. we want to cancel the cycle.
Well, DNA actually doesn't make the rules for the agencies. We're not the policing agency that oversees what each of the agencies do.
Okay.
Their contract and their policies are individual to each of those agencies. And
what
they do.
Speak for your agency, how about?
Pardon me?
How about your agency? How does that?
Our agency does not compensate a donor until she's gone through a retrieval. But she is entitled to, because of the effort and the time that she's putting into it, she's entitled to a certain amount of compensation before the retrieval. However, we don't pay her until the cycle is completed. In Illinois, we can't pay a donor for her ex, so we can only pay her for her time.
Right.
But generally, the large amount of compensation isn't paid to a donor until after her cycle's completed. We don't.
That's because she has, at that point, expended more effort and time and involvement, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not paying for eggs.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, we keep it as fair and reasonable and upfront as possible. Everyone knows and has to sign an agreement with attorney referral, attorney consultation, what's involved beforehand, so that they don't get involved in something that they're not comfortable with.
One of the things, it's so important that the ovulatory stimulating meds are taken exactly as prescribed and that the protocol, it's not an easy protocol necessarily to follow. Dr. Chabon, in your clinic, is there someone who works with the egg donor to make certain that she is doing the meds correctly?
Yes, I just want to add something first to the last questions
sure.
and answers.
Please do.
In terms of the number of eggs, if we screen the donors before we start with antral follicle counts and other methods, this should almost never happen if the donor takes the medications properly. And I agree that if it's a very low situation with looking like there's going to be one or two or three eggs, this probably should be canceled. It's a discussion that should be had with the recipient couple to see if they want to go forward with a very low number of eggs or would they prefer to have the cycle canceled. This almost never happens now that we screen carefully up front. But I also want to say I think there's too much focus on the number of eggs. And what I mean by that is I don't mean by the agencies. I mean by the intended parents.
Mm-hmm.
They're often very focused on the number of eggs they're going to get and how many eggs does this donor give before and that sort of thing. I really don't find much correlation at all with the number of eggs that we get from a donor and the chance for having a baby with that cycle. So some of our very best donors ever over the years have been people that gave between 4 and 8 eggs every time they went through, which is very low. But if the quality's high and the embryos are good, we've had twins from cycle after cycle and some of the donors that gave very low numbers of eggs and sometimes freezing as well in those cycles. So,
you know, we've done some shows on just that. That's it's an interesting concept, which is kind of the less is more, that there's actually a higher relationship to, there's some evidence that would be a higher quality egg is produced when there are fewer of them produced. So that's a very interesting point that you raise. What about helping the donors with their making certain that they're doing the meds correctly?
Right. So we actually are different in that regard. Years ago, we let the donors do their own shots, and I saw too many cases where a donor that should have been responding beautifully was not responding well at all, or it was an erratic response. So what we do is bring the donors in every single day, and we give them the shots, or we watch them take the shots themselves. So that's a hassle for the donor. They don't like it necessarily, but that's my preference, and in my program, it works very well. We don't have problems with inconsistent response because we know they're getting their meds.
Well, that would certainly be, that would mean that your donor would need to be willing, but they know that up front, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, they're told that up front, and if they're not willing to do that, then we don't use them.
Teresa, how many times can a donor donate? And does repeated donations hurt the quality of the egg, or is it just that we don't want the donor to be exposed repeatedly to the ovulatory stimulating drugs?
Well, I'll answer the first part of the question. I'll let the doctor answer the second part because he's really the expert in terms of the medical aspect. But the ASRM recommends a maximum of 6 donations. And I think it is important, especially for women who haven't had children. I know that some couples, some doctors will allow them to go beyond the 6, maybe do an extra one for a sibling project. But beyond that, I think the doctor can give you a little bit more on the medical side. But really, 6 is what the ASRM recommends that we follow.
And Dr. Chabon, is that recommendation primarily because of the health of the donor?
I'll be frank about it. I don't have the inside scoop, but I suspect that a committee got together and had a nice lunch in a hotel somewhere and argued about what the number should be and came up with 6. And there were probably some saying 3 and some saying 10. Most programs before those guidelines came out that I know of limited it to 4. So, and that's what we did. And then the guidelines came out and said 6. It was a little bit of a surprise. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I just don't think there's any real data on anything in terms of how many is too many. So, I think the 6 is pretty arbitrary, and I'm not saying it's unreasonable. I think it's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
We used to do 4, and now we do up to 6. I'm a little bit nervous if the donor doesn't have kids, that I think it's possible that 6 may be too many, but that's just my own feeling. I don't have any data to support that. We don't know that it hurts their fertility at all. I wouldn't do it if I thought it hurt their fertility at all.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we can't prove that it doesn't hurt their fertility because these women have not been followed for 20 years to see what happens after giving, going through 6 egg donations, and they're 38 and they want to have kids. Are they just as fertile as the average 38-year-old, or is something different? We don't know.
I think at one time people brought up the ethical dilemma, too, of multiple donations. Sperm donors can donate multiple times, and the limitations are very different there, and you can go from agency to agency. I guess the same is true with an egg donor, but I think people don't always think in terms of how many children are out there with the same DNA as the donor and intended parents that she's worked with, multiple intended parents that she's worked with. I think we always seem to think about the medical risks before we think about the ethical and psychological risks, too, and I think that's, worth talking about.
Well, that leads right a perfect segue into a question we have from Lisa, at least if I'm understanding where you're going with this. Lisa says, my husband is worried that if we have a child from a donated egg, that that child might marry his half-sister. This seems silly because the odds are against it, but he wanted me to ask your experts whether parents are told how many other times the donor has donated and if it was successful. What about other times that they have conceived? Will they be told if the donor donated again and if any children were born? I think, is that where you were going, Nancy, with the idea?
It's definitely part of it, and I know Teresa can help me with this one, too. In our agency, I operate an agency called the Center for Egg Options in Illinois, but in our agency, we address this issue by having intended parents or intended fathers giving us their birth date, and we ask the donor for her birth date. We give the other party, the parents, we give them the donor's birth date, and we give the donor the parent, the intended father's birth date. This will hopefully prevent this child from meeting the intended parent's child from meeting the donor's child if they're opposite sex and wanting to get married and have a baby. That's providing that their parents and the donor have talked to their children about the fact that they helped in a cycle. If you don't talk about it, no one's going to know, obviously, that this even happened. But that doesn't allow for other cycles that the donor's done that we may not know about. Let's say someone donated embryos somewhere, or let's say there were frozen embryos from someone's previous cycle with the same donor and we didn't find out about a pregnancy. We can't inform every intended parent about every birth. That would be a very difficult process to do.
Don't some people choose a donor who is geographically quite distant from them to alleviate this concern?
I think it's not only the intended parents who want a donor to be away for that same reason, but you have to think about the other people that the donor is going to be working with. I think Teresa can help me with this one, but there are donors all over the country. You don't know where that donor is going to move to. You don't know where that intended parent, that couple is going to move to. You don't know who the donor will donate for in the future. We try not to match parents with donors from the same geographical area. We also work on not matching parents with donors who worked with a couple from the same area. That's important too. But you have to think about what you're working with, what information you can have, and mm-hmm. how you can prevent these things from happening in the future.
Teresa, what's your experience on this one?
Well, I think that's a huge issue in the industry because we really don't know, where the resulting children are, first of all. And we also don't really have a grasp on donors donating. There are some donors, although I wouldn't suspect it's the majority of them, that will donate, maybe six times through one agency, and then they'll move on somewhere else. So there is an issue, and I know that that I'm involved in a group that's trying to work to obtain some sort of donor registry or develop a donor registry. But I will tell you that it's going to be something that's very, very much in the future because of the cost and the ability to get people to provide this information. But I think it really is needed.
There was a discussion that I attended at the ASRM conference this past
mm-hmm.
October, and I was actually surprised that it was more positively received than I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of a voluntary registry, but I agree that it seems like that is going to be from my experience in this show, the vast majority of people do not tell their children, and as a result are going to be very hesitant to register their child on a registry when their child does not know that they were conceived through donor gamete. So
I think more and more people are telling their children from my experience. When I started 10 years ago, people were not even talking about egg donation, but I think people are much more open, especially with their psychological counseling, to disclosing this information to their children, their family, their close friends.
What percentage of donors any of your practices are willing to be contacted in the future? For instance, if there was a medical emergency and they needed medical history or they needed bone marrow or whatever, are most donors' donations still totally anonymous with no ability to contact in the future? Nancy, I'll start with you.
Well, I think most agencies, especially the agencies on DNA, are record-keeping agencies, and they will try and find the intended parents or the donor to get information back and forth. I myself have worked with every single donor that I've worked with, and we've done 2,000 cycles. Every single donor I've worked with is willing to be contacted for a medical emergency or if it's in the child's best interest. Of course, when they sign a contract, and Teresa, you're the legal expert, they can change their mind in the future. But at this point, the donors that we work with are willing to be contacted for emergencies and if it's in the child's best interest.
Which is a great way to phrase it because that leaves it open for other things that we don't anticipate. Teresa, is that your experience as well?
It is. I mean, I with proper counseling, I mean, these donors are very, aware of what they're helping create, and it's a child. I know with our agency, donors actually are counseled and have to agree to do that, and I haven't had one walk away that says, no, I will not do it, because they understand the magnitude of what's occurring here.
Yeah, I guess that raises the issue of one thing that people need to be concerned about when they choose an agency is what plans the agency has for the future maintenance of records, even if that agency no longer exists. So what should a parent ask to see when they're choosing an agency to guarantee that these records will be around, Teresa?
Well, I mean, one of the things I would do is require that the agency put that in their retainer agreement, what they're going to do, how they're handled. I know that that's something that we do, but there's no actual legal requirements. I mean, the doctor and myself, and I as an attorney, we have certain record requirements, but they don't go on until the child is of a certain age. So I think that that's one of the reasons that donor registry is important, or maybe just for the purposes of maintaining this information, because it does become cumbersome. We've actually started doing it where it's actually all, you know, placed in a database and it's held there. But again, you know, the amount of information, as it grows. I mean, as Nancy stated, you know, there's 2,000 cycles that she's done. I mean, that's a lot of information.
Right, and it has to be maintained for a long period of time, not just until the child's 10, not just
exactly.
until the child's 18. I mean, this person at 30, the child may at some point at 38 mm-hmm. Find out something significant about their health and either want to share it with their donor or get information from the donor.
Correct.
Yeah, so it's got to be
yeah.
maintained for a long period of time.
And we think that the kids are entitled to this information. I think the FDA requires that we keep records for 10 years, but then there's records at the doctor's office
mm-hmm.
and perhaps
mm-hmm.
at the attorney. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have to assign them to a fiduciary or someone else who takes over for us. But, you know, there are costs involved and there's storage involved.
Mm-hmm.
But is that included as part of what you should be asking and expecting from your clinic or from your donor agency?
I think it's something that's really important to ask. And my background is in nursing. I'm a nurse. And so for medical reasons, I think that that's important. Psychologically, I also think that's important because I'm, you know, pretty passionate about what I do. And, yeah, I do think it's definitely something to ask, and it should be addressed, agreed, in an agreement. That's in my agreement here. And all of the agencies that we work with on DNA are agencies that seem to be doing the same.
Here's a question from D. My eggs are kaput, so our only hope of having a baby on our own is using donated eggs. My husband is freaked out about using someone's eggs that he doesn't know. He wants us to ask my cousin, who is 23, to donate her eggs. Could you ask your guests their opinion about using a known donor versus using an unknown donor? Well, yes, Dee, I will. But I also want to point out to you that in addition to the practical and the legal issues that our guests can talk about, there are some psychological issues. And we have talked about these issues with psychologists on several other of our shows on forming your family through egg donation. So I would suggest you listen to that, too. All right, Teresa, let me ask you, what could you suggest to Dee about any issues about using a known versus an unknown donor?
I think the biggest issues that I have is I always like to make sure that the donor has, well, of course, psychologically screened, but specifically for the purpose, we want to make sure that she's signing the agreement and she's going through the cycle without being under duress. I mean, if your aunt comes to you or a cousin comes to you, immediately a lot of people want to help, but, you know, there's also some reluctance, I'm sure, at some point. So that really needs to be something that the psychologist goes over in order to make sure that she understands what she's doing. And the other thing, too, is that what I have seen in the past is, you know, everybody's parenting skills are different, and so the donor needs to understand that, you know, she's not the parent of the child, and that they are the parents of the child, and they need to parent according to the way that they parent without being having, you know, their parental rights in any way impeded on.
Here's a question for Dr. Chabon that's coming in from Liz. This may be a silly question, but my sister has volunteered to give us her eggs. She is 32, and she smokes 2 packs a day and parties pretty heavy, maybe once or twice a month. Can her smoking or drinking hurt the eggs?
Smoking is not good for eggs. I'm not aware of any data on drinking in terms of impact on egg quality. But smoking definitely can have a detrimental effect on egg supply and egg quality. However, we had a donor that was one of those donors that I mentioned earlier that got everybody pregnant, and she refused to quit smoking, and we told her we were going to stop using her, and she said, that's fine. I called the recipients to tell them that the donor wouldn't quit smoking. They said, we'll use her anyway. And she continued to have cycles that were successful. That was through screening for nicotine that we picked up that she was smoking. So in other words, some smokers will be extremely fertile. On the average, it's not good for egg quantity or quality, though.
To say nothing of her lungs, but that's not the subject of this show, I realize. Let's see, Nancy, is it harder for minorities to find a minority donor?
Not in Chicago, not in a big city. On DNA, there are donors from all over the country, but my agency, most of our donors are local. No, it really isn't. We have donors from all ethnic backgrounds on DNA. We have donors that are all different races, biracial, mixed race, combinations that you probably had never even heard of. I think if you go or are looking for a donor from a smaller town and the pool is smaller, obviously you're going to have less choice. But if you're looking through an agency that has, you know, 100-plus donors, you'll have probably very good numbers to choose from, and you'll be able to choose a donor that meets what you're looking for, maybe exceeds what you're looking for, as long as you have those choices.
All right. Because the Creating a Family has done so much on frozen embryo disposition issues, the consent issue has come up on several shows, including one we just recently did on donating embryos for research. Teresa, what type of consent is needed from donors that would allow the intended parents to do whatever they wanted with any leftover unused embryos?
Again, going back to what we talked about earlier, the informed consent through the physician's office has to actually mirror the legal agreement between the donor and the intended parents. So she needs to be aware, you know, what the parents need to be aware of what the donor is willing to do. I've seen some donors recently that really want to know if the parents are going to donate to another couple so they can keep track. I mean, these are smart donors that kind of really know the situation, that want to make sure, and I recommend that to all donors, that they kind of keep track of their donations. And so that agreement is really going to say whether or not they can donate to another couple or donate to science, and the donor has to agree to that.
So that needs to be agreed to up front, and as I understand it, there is some specific language which the NIH now requires, as I understand it, that the donor must agree to or must be stated. So in this case, would it be important that intended parents and donors alike, but this show is more aimed for intended parents, that they have an attorney look over any agreements, or is this pretty standard now with any donating agencies?
I would say that the donor should always have someone review the agreements. I mean, I know that some donors, if they've done it, you know, four or five times, they've seen it, the same agreement over and over, may feel comfortable doing it. I, of course, don't recommend that, but people do that. They could waive counsel. But definitely an attorney should go over the informed consent and the agreement between the parent, them and the parents, so they understand, because a lot of times they don't understand the ramifications, although it's in plain English. They don't really understand the whole process when they're a first-time donor.
And Dr. Chabon, this will be our last question. Let me ask it to you. Do donors have a right to say who they want their eggs to be donated to? Say, for instance, they say that I only want to donate to a married couple or to a heterosexual couple or to a couple that practices my religion or whatever. Is that something that you see, and is that something that a donor does often say?
No, I haven't seen it. I'm sure it's happened. I haven't seen it, and in my opinion, they don't have a right to do that, but someone else would have a different opinion, potentially.
Most of the agencies on DNA will ask the donor who she is not willing to work with. If she is not willing to work with, you know, someone who's single or same-sex couple, and that, again, will be her preference, too.
And then that's the case, and that profile will simply not be shown to somebody who doesn't meet those criteria.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Well, we have reached the end of our hour. Thank you so much, Nancy Block with Donor Network Alliance, Teresa Erickson with Erickson Law, and Dr. Richard Chabon with the Advanced Fertility Center of Chicago. Also, I want to say if you are considering creating your family through egg donation, I strongly encourage you to visit the wonderful group and the wonderful website, Parents Via Egg Donation. They a wonderful support group and a great forum for and a safe place to ask all of your questions. To get more information on the Donor Network Alliance, go to DonorNetworkAlliance.com. And for more information on Dr. Richard Chabon and the Advanced Fertility Center of Chicago, you go to theadvancedfertility.com. And I do want to say I love that website. It has one of the best collections of embryo pictures I've ever seen, as well as a very great visual on how embryos are graded. So if, regardless of who you're using or whatever, it's a great website to go to see when you hear that your embryo has a certain grade, that you can actually see the pictures. And I think that it's great in helping people understand that concept. And to get more information on Teresa Erickson and her practice, go to ericksonlaw.net. If you have found this show helpful, please post about it and link to it so others can listen as well. This show will be archived on the 2010 Big List at the radio page of creatingafamily.org, and it's also available for download as a podcast from iTunes. The easiest way to find it on iTunes is to use the iTunes button on our radio page. You can also, of course, just go to iTunes and type in Creating a Family in their search box, and it'll pop up there as well. Our shows are evenly divided between infertility and adoption, and next week's show, which will be March 3rd, we're going to be talking about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and screening, who should consider it, how effective it is, and what it can tell you. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.